All right, let's go through our memory work one more time. Last time we'll be doing this, and I want to say, before we say it, how much I have appreciated you doing the work to learn this and doing it traditionally auditorium classes, and I've taught a lot of auditorium classes over the years, have been the worst about getting them to do memory work because, you know, everybody, once they get about 25, says, well, I'm too old to learn anything new, you know, blah, you know, and you haven't done that. You have done a great job, and it's really been an encouragement to me. Let's do Titus 2, 11 through 14. For the grace of God that brings salvation has appeared to all men, teaching us that denying ungodliness and worldly lust, we should live soberly, righteously, and godly in the present age, looking for the blessed hope and glorious appearing of our great God and Savior, Jesus Christ, who gave Himself for us, that He might redeem us from every lawless deed and purify for Himself His own special people, zealous for good works. Super, super passage. You know, and not that one passage is more important than another, but this is one that just seems to bring so many great thoughts together in a short little space there. Great, great text to remember. Second one, Matthew 7, 21 through 23. Not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, shall enter the kingdom of heaven, but he who does the will of my Father in heaven. Many will say to me in that day, Lord, Lord, have we not prophesied in your name, cast out demons in your name, and done many wonders in your name? And then I will declare to them, I never knew you. Depart from me, you who practice lawlessness. You know, I hope that I've been able to communicate some details to you this quarter, that you'll remember some things. But if you don't remember everything we've covered, and you remember, you come out of this with a stronger commitment to doing the will of the Father, a stronger commitment to Bible authority, it will have been time well spent. Because people with that kind of commitment, they go back and they find the answers. But in our society today, there's just the tendency to treat the will of the Father as though it means the suggestions of the Father. You know, they're just this, you know, just love God, be sincere, and nothing else really matters. We've got to be committed to knowing and doing the will of the Father. Last one, dealing with worship, John 4, 23 and 24. But the hour is coming and now is when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and truth, for the Father is seeking such to worship Him. God is spirit, and those who worship Him must worship Him in spirit and truth. All right. As I've already said, this is my last time out here until July in the class. I hope I get to preach a few times between now and July. But, you know, Lord willing, I will be the teacher again in July as we will study James, 1st and 2nd Peter then. But I've enjoyed this class. Appreciate the study, your comments. Again, the effort you put into the memory work. And on the subject of the church, you know, I really hope that you've learned some things, and I hope that we've challenged you to think non-denominationally, to really get back to not the traditions of our fathers, not the way we've always heard it. You know, and sometimes the way you've always heard it can be correct, but that's not the reason you want to do it. You want to do it because this is what the New Testament teaches. You know, thinking that way about it. Don't forget the importance of authority. Matthew 7, 21. Not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, shall enter the kingdom of heaven, but he who does the will of my Father in heaven. Hebrews 5, 9. Jesus is author of eternal salvation to whom? Those that obey Him. We've got to be an obedient people. Revelation 22, 18 and 19. What did John warn the reader about doing? Adding or taking away from the things that were written in that book. Take the Scriptures, follow them. The organization of the New Testament church really is very simple. You would think this ought to be one of those lessons that we shouldn't have to spend a whole lot of time on. You know, Acts 14, 21 through 23, as they were making their return, they appointed elders in every church. Titus 1, 5, for this reason I left you in Crete. You'd set in order the things that are lacking, and ordain elders in every city, or appoint elders in every city. Elders in every church is the pattern. And first thing I want to say about that in way of review is don't change that. Let's not attempt to create any other kind of organizational structure. Not bigger, not larger, not intertwining of churches. Don't change that pattern. But sometimes in churches that are committed to not going, shall we say, beyond, there's not really a commitment to the development of that. And the way we become committed to the development of elders is we become committed to being disciples. As we talked a few weeks ago, or maybe it was last Wednesday night, elders grow out of committed disciples. If we are a group in which we are committed, yes, there will be some, about half that'll fall by the wayside as far as appointment of elders because they are female. So we're going to rule out half, no matter how committed you are, you're not going to be an elder. There will be a few men that won't ever get married. Maybe get married, never have children. There will be some that abilities that just, that's just not within their realm. Just like, I'm not a song leader. There's some that are not going to be able to be that because of service. But if we have got a group of people, and I'll tell you, the women are a part of this, because it is almost impossible for a man to become an elder if he's not married to a committed disciple. And the two people working together, we ought to see that. Hebrews 13:17 talks about being in submission to those that lead. They watch for our souls. He said, as those that must give account, let them do so with joy, not with grief. Let's have that as our commitment. Now, tonight we're talking about number three, institutionalism. This has been a hot issue among churches of Christ since about 1849. Anybody know what took place in 1849 in Cincinnati, Ohio? I know there were probably several things that happened that year, but the American Christian Missionary Society was founded. And who was its first president? Alexander Campbell. That was the beginning of discussions that would be troublesome for years to come, still are troublesome. Just very quickly to remind you of the definition, and on the, as always, I'm striving to be as, not to define it in a way that's prejudicial. Institutionalism just is the idea that churches either establish or contribute to organizations that somebody else establishes as a means of carrying out their work. Sometimes it's applied into the sponsoring church arrangement that we want to talk about a little bit more tonight, in which several churches send money to another church to do a work bigger than what any can afford. As we talked about Sunday morning, the first time, when we talk about using organizations, contributing or establishing, we're talking about the fact that churches will send money to an orphanage or a foster care facility, or, a senior citizen's home, or a college, or a school, in order for them to do a work on behalf of the church. The second, the sponsoring church, is more commonly used for television, radio, evangelistic efforts. And the thing that we talked about Sunday, well, first of all, just to show you again the diagram, the chart, You get an organization in the middle. The churches, and you could have many more of these, they send their funds here. You know, the board of trustees, the board of directors, you know, whoever, they decide then how to take care of this needy person, how to educate this student. But you've got someone between the church and the work. And as I said Sunday, you just don't have any indication. There's just no positive authority to suggest that churches ever had any kind of go-between, any kind of middle agency. If something was the work of the church, and that's part of what I want to talk about a little bit tonight, if it's a work of the church, then the church did the work. When, you know, there were those that needed care in Jerusalem, they gathered the disciples together and they chose from within the group. When funds were needed, you know, by the churches in Judea, they were given to the elders. It was done within the church, not by the establishment of a second organization. Now that's really what we covered Sunday. Questions, comments about that before we get to the next part of it, which is, are these organizations sometimes doing works that weren't really assigned to the church? Okay. Let's look at this. And we really talked about this some back in, my notes say week 9, and I'm going to trust them. The question of Christians helping non-Christians, churches out of the treasury giving to non-Christians. I want you to look at a few passages with me. Starting in Acts 11. Now this is what we sometimes call a pattern. Verse 27. And in these days, prophets came from Jerusalem to Antioch. Then one of them, named Agabus, stood up and showed by the Spirit that there was going to be a great famine throughout all the world, which also happened in the days of Claudius Caesar. Then the disciples, each according to his ability, determined to send relief to the brethren dwelling in Judea. This they also did, and sent it to the elders by the hands of Barnabas and Saul. Now, who did they decide to send relief to? The brethren in Judea. Do you suppose this famine only affected the brethren dwelling in Judea, or affected all people dwelling in Judea? Hard to imagine a famine that only affected the brethren, and yet he just says, for the brethren. Look at 1 Corinthians 1, in verse 1 Corinthians 16, in verse 1. Had the one right, it was supposed to be chapter 16. 1 Corinthians 16, verse 1. Now concerning the collection for the saints. Now, the saints that he's going to be talking about are those in Jerusalem. Turn to 2 Corinthians 8. Dealing with the same thing that he was talking about in 1 Corinthians 16. Verse 4. Imploring us with much urgency that we would receive the gift and the fellowship of the ministering to the saints. Chapter 9, verse 1. Now concerning the ministering to the saints, it is superfluous for me to write to you. Ministering to the saints. Now back up to Romans 15. And the reason, this is one of those things, I don't know if y'all have ever picked up on this, but typically when I'm giving on any one point, I try to make my verses go front to back. You know, if I'm going to read three passages on baptism, I start at the front of the Bible and I go forward. On this one, I'm jumping backwards for a reason. The reason being, this is the order in which they were written. You know, 1 Corinthians was written from Ephesus on the third journey. Then 2 Corinthians was written a little later while he was up in Macedonia. And then Romans was written after he had arrived in Corinth. So we're taking them in the order they're written. But in Romans 15, verse 25, "But now I am going to Jerusalem to minister to the saints. For it pleased those from Macedonia and Achaia to make a certain contribution for the poor among the saints who are in Jerusalem." Verse 31, "That I may be delivered from those in Judea who do not believe, and that my service for Jerusalem may be acceptable to the saints." Repeatedly, these are the words he uses. The answer to the question is that Christians, those of us as individual disciples, we ought to help anybody that we can. You know, we don't have an obligation, you know, just to family, just to friends, just to our brethren. As we have opportunity, let us do good to all men, especially to those of the household of faith. You know, there is a special responsibility toward our fellow saints, but we owe it to everybody. But as a church, you know, 1 Timothy 5:16, concerning the widows, he said, "Do not let the church be charged." There were some that the individual Christian was to take care of. There were some the church was to take care of. On this subject, you know, it's just not the mission of the church to take care of all. You know, I think that, you know, sometimes we look at this and we say, well, you know, why doesn't the church? I just can't believe the church doesn't help everybody. Well, this is the pattern. God gave the church a work, and it was several works to do. He didn't give the church every work to do. You know, somebody sent me a thing to, you know, point out the March of Dimes. You know, the March of Dimes, large charitable organization, they don't do famine relief in Ethiopia. You know, they're not relieving the victims of the tsunami in Japan. They have a purpose. They were founded for a purpose, you know, dealing with birth defects, premature births. That's their focus of their organization. You know, nobody criticizes them for saying, well, you know, we've got a focus. This is our work. God gave the church a work, and I don't believe it includes this. Now, let me mention one passage. 2 Corinthians chapter 9, in verse 13, is the one passage that some people will say Galatians 6:10 speaks to the churches. I'm not going to take time to go back through that. You just start, read Galatians 6, 1 through 10, and look who he's talking to. He's talking to individuals. As a man sows, that he'll also reap. But 2 Corinthians 9 is definitely talking about a collective work. And let's pick up at verse 12. "For the administration of this service not only supplies the needs of the saints, but also is abounding through many thanksgivings to God, while through the proof of this ministry, they glorify God for the obedience of your confession to the gospel of Christ, and for your liberal sharing with them and all men." And, you know, here is a passage. Some say, well, you know, in 2 Corinthians 9 and verse 13, he said they not only gave it to the saints, but they gave it to all men. Of course, you may notice the word men is in italics, meaning supplied. You look at this passage, 1 Corinthians 16, which is writing about this collection, he says, the collection for the saints. In 2 Corinthians 8 and 9, what he's doing is telling them, get on the stick. You guys said you were going to do this. You made a promise a year ago. You've not been doing it. And what does he say in chapter 8, verse 4? The ministering to the saints. Chapter 9, verse 1, the ministering to the saints. Verse 12, he mentions the saints. Romans 15, which, as I said, is written later, Paul now has the money. The Corinthians now have given whatever they're going to give, and he's got it in hand. And three times he says it's for the saints. Never a reference to anyone other than the saints. quote from Tyndale's commentary, the Tyndale commentary series, by a fellow who probably would have no problem, you know, the commentary series, I believe, written by Anglicans, but I'm not absolutely certain of that. He probably wouldn't have any problem with the church taking on a lot of works that I would have a problem with. But writing about this, he says that the Corinthians' contribution is for the poor saints at Jerusalem only. Because that's who Paul says over and over again, that's who it's for. But he said the spirit of fellowship in that is for all Christians. That's what he believes the all has reference to. That yes, they're only directly aiding at this point the saints at Jerusalem, the poor saints at Jerusalem. But they would help any Christian. And I think that says well what Paul was getting at. Because over and over again he says, for the saints. And by the way, some of you noticed this and asked about the little booklet, Issues of the 50s and 60s, the name of suddenly slipped me. The series of three sermons that Bill Hall preached here, I don't know how many years ago, been transcribed. If you don't have a copy of that or if you've never read it, I'd encourage you to get one of those. He deals with all of these issues. Not really, it's not necessarily an in-depth, but he gives a lot more detail on what we're doing in this class. I meant to say that. Any question or comment, anybody? Bradley. Yeah. When he did those here, it was before our recordings were up to the quality they are now. I would match our quality up about against anybody's now, but in the old days, and that has nothing to do with the sermons themselves. I'm talking about the recording quality. But they are available, and I would encourage you to study those. It's a good reference to it. Let me add one other thing on this, on question number three. We've already answered this. The church in the first century, it was about teaching. It was about spreading the gospel. But you don't read about any missionary societies. You don't read about, you know, colleges and schools being founded. The church did its work. And, you know, and I want to challenge this. I've tried to say all along through this quarter, when we have to do what I consider a negative thing, say, this is the wrong, let's make sure we always see what the right is. It's wrong to have instrumental music. What's right, what we must maintain, is that worship in spirit and truth. That we must be a people who not just avoid instrumental music, but worship God the way we ought. On this subject, we need to make sure that we're not just the people who avoid doing things the wrong way, but we do things the right way. That we are diligent about preaching the gospel, about teaching the Word of God. And when those situations arise, the relieving the needs of the saints. That opposition to institutionalism is never an excuse for do-nothingism. Now, granted, you can do all manner of things the Bible lays out, but you don't have a big, grand organization. There are those who see you as doing nothing. And there's nothing you can do about that. I mean, that's like people that say, well, y'all don't believe in music. Well, yeah, I believe in music. I just believe in the kind of music that God sets forth. Be a people are busy about the work of God. I won't go to number four, but any comments on three? Yes, Jeff? You say that, and there's something that I bring this up a lot of times in instrumental music. There's a reason you don't ever read about the apostles getting on an airplane. You know, they never took the train to go anywhere because those things didn't exist. But instruments of music were available for worship. The Jews had been using them for at least 1,000 years. And they're never mentioned as used by the Christians. Schools existed in the first century. You know, and, you know, there were, in certain parts of the Roman Empire, there were a lot of orphans. That was not the work of the church. It just simply wasn't. Let's look at the sponsoring church, which is, you know, something we, historically, it was one of the great issues because of the Herald of Truth, and I'll say a little more about that in just a moment. But what happens is a church takes on a work larger than what it can finance. And then what has been, the way of justifying it has been, well, you see, Jerusalem, they were a needy church. And churches of Galatia, Macedonia, and Achaia, they sent money to Jerusalem to help that needy church. They couldn't meet the needs they had. And so what has happened is sometimes churches today have created, and let me just, you know, then they ask other churches. What they end up doing is overseeing a work that belongs to several churches. You get the sponsoring church, which is, in many cases, is a big church, and they say, well, we're going to do a radio program that's going to be national, a TV program. We're going to blanket the world, you know, with Bibles. And so they go out and they commit themselves to spending more money than what they have. And then they put out the word and say, we're a needy church. You know, well, you can see a lot of problems with that, I hope. You're not, and I apologize for not changing those arrows to white, but I hope you can see them. They're flowing this way from the churches and then out that way. The sponsoring church is saying, we here in the center, our eldership will oversee the work of multiple churches. And it might be, sometimes it actually involves them overseeing another church. But, you know, incredibly. You know, they'll go out and they'll establish a mission church. And with money that these churches are sending to that church, then they're overseeing this church. And there have been some situations in which this church would actually, I could have another era going this way. They send their contributions on the first day of the week. They have to send them back to the sponsoring church because the sponsoring church is, their elders are overseeing them. I hope I don't even have to explain to you what's wrong with all of that. I raised a question, and if you get a concordance out, how many references do you find to contributing churches, sponsoring churches, and mission churches? Obviously, there aren't any, are there? You don't. What do you have in the New Testament? You have churches. There's never such a thing as a mission church, a sponsoring church, a mother church. That's terminology you'll hear today. But it's not New Testament terminology. I want you to think about this. One of the reasons the sponsoring church arrangement originated is Christians recognize there's a problem with that previous chart I had where you had an organization in the middle. You know, they were sending money to a missionary society or to a college. Someone said, but an eldership, that's a divine organization. You know, so we will send it to that. When elders are overseeing anything other than a local church, they are no longer acting as New Testament elders. This is not, the sponsoring church is not God's divine organization. A local group of Christians, overseen by elders, served by deacons, that is God's organization. This multi-church organization, that's not God's organization. You know, is the Supreme Court a part of the United States government, lawful part of our government? Yes. That answer is yes, you know. I know y'all, been a little while since you started constitutional law, you know, unlike me. But what if the Supreme Court announced late tonight that they have declared war on Iran? What would be the problem with that? Do what? Why can't they declare war? But aren't it in the Supreme Court part of the federal government? That's not their delegated powers. That's exactly. I mean, we're right on. That the Supreme Court has its function. Elders have a function. Just go through it. Acts 20:28. What were they to do? Shepherd the flock of God which is among you, or the among which the Holy Spirit has made you overseers. 1 Peter 5. Shepherd the church of God, the flock of God which is among you. Elders in every church. They're never given the authority to act in a multi-church capacity. Now, that's not what they've been taught to do. We've looked at these passages. When the disciples in Antioch wanted to help the disciples in Judea, where did they send the money? The elders of the various churches. In fact, we don't actually have any specific of them handing it off to the elders in Jerusalem. We just know they went by there. Galatians 1:22, there were churches in Judea. You know, they went. Now, I will tell you, I have heard it said that they gave it to the elders of Jerusalem, who then dispersed it to all the various churches of Judea. To me, to reach that conclusion, you have to read it through the modern prism. Because what he says is they sent it to Judea, to the elders. The pattern that I consistently read is elders in every church. Acts 14 says it. Elders in every city. Titus 1 says it. Galatians 1:22 makes clear, even before that time, there were multiple churches in Judea. The pattern would have been elders everywhere. You know, the churches of Galatia, Macedonia, and Achaia, think about what they did. They sent money to Jerusalem because there were poor saints there. And you come to this question, you don't ever read of one church sending money to another church for any purpose other than a legitimate, benevolent need. You know, this business of, you know, going back into the late 40s and the early 50s, the Fifth and Highland Church in Abilene, Texas was the sponsoring church for the Herald of Truth. First a national TV radio program, then it became a national TV program. You know, and they wanted to compare themselves to Jerusalem, a needy church. Fifth and Highland was a wealthy congregation. It would be like if I went out and I could get somebody to sell it to me, a $2 million home. I bought several new Mercedes, and then I had a BMW just on the side, you know, as my extra. I bought a lake house. I bought a speedboat because if you're gonna live on the lake, you got to be able to move up and down fast. And then I came to the elders and I said, guys, I am broke. You know, y'all going to have to relieve the needs of this saint. I'm a needy saint. Well, first thing, you know, they'd say, that's a self-created need. You know, you're not needy. You know, you've overspent. You've overcommitted. the New Testament pattern. These were legitimate needs. There's just no authority for multi-church works. It's not. At least I can't find it. Now, I go back and I think it flashed through real quickly because I was trying to get through all this. The aims of some of these middleman organizations, the aims of the multi-church, the sponsoring church arrangement, many of them have been very noble. And, you could pick out individuals in it all who were probably some power-hungry individuals that liked the idea of being over churches and over things. But that's not the main problem. That's not the majority. The majority of people who were involved in the creation of the colleges, trying to get churches to support colleges and schools and radio and television programs on this international level, were well-intentioned people who had noble aims, but somehow lost sight of we've got to have that positive authority for what we do. We need God's will behind us. And understand that we can set out with the noblest of intentions, but we've got to always be getting back. Okay, now, before I go any further, what does the Bible say? Where does it go? You know, don't let the intentions fuel the emotions. Because once we get ourselves down the road, and then we start trying to justify how we got there, it's harder to look at the Scriptures objectively. And that's so often what happens. That we've already gotten something going, and then we're trying to figure out, okay, how do I justify where I am? Enjoyed it, folks. Hope this has been helpful to you.